Cold and clear is what we're getting for weather today around the Pacific Northwest. Good morning, everybody. I'm John Carlson's producer. In for John today, I'm Phil Vandervoort, along with the radio legend, Mark Christopher.
You mean the boss is away and we shall play.
Did you have fog this morning? No, I didn't.
Nothing
really
at Hood Canal
like
on
that.
The way in, even on the ferry boat. It was nice and clear compared to even going home yesterday. It was like a mile visibility for me.
Yeah. We're just in one of those stretches where we're getting the cold and clear, so that means fog in the morning. And
Snohomish County's got the worst of it, we're hearing.
Burns off, and overall, you know, fairly mild. The East Coast is getting kicked again with snow and all that lake effect stuff, so we'll be happy to be here where it's sort of manageable and mild. John's just taking today off. He'll be back tomorrow. We'll do Legendary Lyrics tomorrow on a Wednesday show, so it's Mark and me for today on Tuesday. And then John's going to take a couple days off here at the end of the week, and Ari Hoffman will be in on Thursday and Friday. So that's a little bit of what's happening right now. But thanks for sticking with us this morning, and we'll take it up to Markley Van Camp and Robbins at 9 o'clock here on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
And we've not to worry, because producer, you can adjust to make a show worth listening to.
I'll say this. I'm always a little bit nervous when, you know, we need to make these adjustments and you and I take over for John. And I think we've rounded up some fantastic stories that you're going to want to hear. I'm going to get into the Daniel Penny trial going on in New York. This is the guy who tried to subdue, I guess, somebody who was acting out and threatening people on a New York subway. Mm-hmm. They put him in a submission hold, a choke hold, and ended up killing him. And then the same district attorney that decided he needed to charge Donald Trump decided to charge Daniel Penny with this guy's death. And the whole case in New York, we'll get to this in just a moment, is now going to closing arguments. And I think the jury could potentially get the case at the end of today and could start deliberating later today and tomorrow. And so I would anticipate that we'll probably have a day or so of deliberations, maybe several hours of deliberations, and we'll get a verdict potentially tomorrow or the next day. So that's why we want to take some time to go through this trial.
And think about it, Phil, with all of us that ride transportation, public transportation, especially in recent years, if something of an issue happened and there was a need for somebody to take somebody down, and somebody suddenly gets out of a chair and puts them in a, you know, a neck hold or whatever you want to call it, would you back that up? Would you think it was over the top?
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, I guess, in this case, that maybe this gentleman went a little too far and held on to
that's what the prosecution's saying, and that's what the jury's going to have to decide. Yeah. Lars Larson will do his regular visit with us here to round out this hour around 6:50 this morning. And I've got a story that's emanating from California, but I think it has obvious implications for Oregon and Washington. And that's whether or not states like Oregon and Washington are going to join in with California and use taxpayer money to provide legal assistance to people that could be facing deportation based on Donald Trump taking office. So that's something that we'll get into with Lars here. And then to start next hour, there are two stories, one out of Tacoma, one out of Redmond, that I want you all to know about. And it underscores a bunch of things that are problematic about our government, our political officials, the policy decisions that our political officials make. Just one part of the story is both of these stories underscore why you are paying so much more in insurance. If you are a renter in an apartment and you have renter's insurance, if you are a homeowner and you have homeowner's insurance, these two stories intersect. There's a lot going on with that. Wow.
I got the frog too. In my throat. Let me add, too, a lot of you were asking, and this was our breaking news just as we got into the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, this cold case of this young girl that was missing back in the 80s. 36 years later, modern technology, way to go, detectives, there in Pierce County with some of the techniques of today. They have a suspect, but all these years later, where did they find the suspect? And with that, we also have a connection of an update that maybe some of this technology will share. And we get to that story of JonBenet Ramsey, who's back in the news here. And the case suddenly is moving along and things are progressing.
Yeah,
and it looks like these two might have
I hadn't realized that there was a JonBenet Ramsey update.
Yeah.
And
so
that was
cover here.
Sensationally covered trial back in the 1990s out of Colorado.
At Christmas time, too.
That's true. Right, it did revolve right before Christmas. And then at 8:35 this morning, Mark and I are going to talk to a couple of guests, And this, again, kind of comes back to something I just mentioned. Washington is following suit with a law in California that's going to drastically impact recreational vehicle dealerships, RV dealers.
Where do you hear this?
And it all revolves around mandating a certain amount of sales of electric RVs, EV RVs. But the problem right now is that no manufacturers are making electric vehicle RVs that will fit into this new law that is coming down the pipe for the state of Washington and some six other states as well. So it's just a perfect example of how the political agenda created by the politicians that want to do all this virtue signaling about climate change and carbon emissions, they start imposing laws without understanding the practical effects of the marketplace because they are clueless about what goes on in the marketplace. They just have this myopia, this blind ambition for anything and everything that's related to a climate agenda. And we'll tell you how it's going to adversely impact jobs
and the RV industry
here in our state.
It's so big in the Northwest, as everybody knows. Think about this. How much does your current RV weigh? What's the length of it? And then when you tune in and hear the story that Phil just mentioned, you'll just start shaking your head going, what is the future of recreational vehicles in larger size?
It parallels this whole vote on I-2066. Should you be allowed to choose that you do or don't want natural gas in new home, new business, new apartment construction? So it's got a lot of parallels in that. So we'll talk about that at 8:35. But let's go to the story out of the trial in New York City. Daniel Penny, he's been put on trial for the death of Jordan Neely. And Jordan Neely was acting erratic. Turned out he ended up having some sort of intoxicants in his system. He was accosting people on a New York City subway train. Daniel Penny, feeling that people were possibly in jeopardy of their safety, ended up putting his arms around this guy and put him into a submission hold or a choke hold. And Jordan Neely ended up dying as a result of this restraint. And the New York City District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, chose to put Daniel Penny on trial for this. So they've gotten down to closing arguments. The jury is going to get the case possibly later today or otherwise first thing tomorrow morning. And I want to go through a couple of summaries that sort of bring you up to date on how this trial wrapped up late last week, right before Thanksgiving break. The Associated Press wrote, many criminal defendants don't take the stand, and juries are routinely instructed that they cannot hold a defendant's silence, which is, you know, your constitutional right, that Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate yourself. A jury cannot hold that against a defendant. And that's what happened in the Daniel Penny case. The defense wrapped up last week. Daniel Penny did not testify on his own behalf. You would think, and a lot of court observers look at that and say, well, that means the defense feels pretty comfortable about how they've refuted the prosecution's case. So one of Penny's lawyers, according to the Associated Press, noted after the court wrapped up last week that jurors did hear from Penny in the form of his recorded statements to police when all this happened, minutes after and hours after Daniel Penny had put Jordan Neely in a chokehold. And so the attorney said, quote, virtually everything Penny said at that time in that police video is consistent and with credible testimony of the fellow passengers. So you've got that corroboration. You've got that consistency is one of the things that kind of concluded right before Thanksgiving at the end of the defense's argument. Now, in relation to that video, Daniel Penny told police that he wrapped his arms around Jordan Neely's neck, took him to the floor of the subway car, and, quote, put him out, end quote, because he was angrily throwing things and making threatening comments to the other passengers. That's what he says Neely was doing. Penny said on that police video that he had not wanted to injure Neely, but rather to keep him from hurting anyone else. A number of other passengers testified that they were scared of Jordan Neely's behavior, and they were relieved that Daniel Penny did grab a hold of him. Now, one of the things that did come up in trial is that a man who later stepped in and held down Jordan Neely's arms when Penny was wrapped around him on the floor of the subway car, that person, that passenger on the train, did tell jurors that he had urged Penny to let go, but that Daniel Penny kept holding on to Neely for a little bit longer. And then prosecutors are saying that what Penny did there was meant to protect people, but he recklessly used too much force, and he overlooked Neely's humanity and made no effort to spare his life. So that's how the prosecution is kind of framing this. There was a city medical examiner that testified on behalf of the prosecution, pathologist that was hired by Daniel Penny's defense team, attempted to dispute and refute the findings of the city medical examiner. And then prosecutors, defense lawyers, and the judge started meeting yesterday to hash out the jury instructions. And that's kind of brings us to where we are this morning on Tuesday. Now, New York TV station WABC reported about the prosecution's case, saying that defense attorneys pointed to possible other causations from the medical report. And this goes to what the defense team had a pathologist testify to, that there was a drug called K2 found in Jordan Neely's system, in his blood, that he had suffered from mental health issues, and that all of those things may have created an acute heart condition. Apparently, sickle cell anemia was something that Jordan Neely suffered from. And so the defense attorney pathologist was testifying that all of those factors could have contributed to this death, not simply a chokehold, as the prosecution claims. So the WABC report continues to say the medical examiner named Dr. Cynthia Harris, who is a City of New York medical examiner, performed Neely's autopsy, firmly rooted her findings and said that those other things are not probable. So that's pretty expected in a court case. You have one expert witness on the prosecution side, another expert witness on the defense side, and they're going to give you differing views, contradicting views. And so the city medical examiner for the prosecution said that from the video, which there's recorded video of Daniel Penny holding on to Jordan Neely on the floor of that subway car when he put him into the chokehold. From the video of that recording and her autopsy findings, she testified that you could see Neely dying within the 5-minute cell phone video that was presented in court. So the city medical examiner, Dr. Harris, testified how critical that cell phone video was in addition to the autopsy results. And then Christopher Neely's uncle Christopher Neely is the uncle of Jordan Neely, and he told WABC in New York, quote, "The defense is basically just going in circles, as what I just call beating around the bush. Since 10 a.m. this morning," this was the day of the testimony, "the questions haven't changed in any manner, and neither has answers from Ms. Harris, the medical examiner. I feel real confident in the defeat of this," meaning the defense witness's account of the manner of death. So there's some perspective from Jordan Neely's uncle. And then also from WABC in New York, defense attorneys were working to cast doubt on the prosecution's medical expert by asking, "Is it fair to say that you have some doubt about the pressure that was applied by Daniel Penny to Jordan Neely?" And that city and prosecution medical examiner kind of responded in a perplexed way, according to WABC, saying, quote, "It's the arm of an adult man." And then the WABC story wraps up by saying, "That line of questioning by the defense to the prosecution's medical expert witness says the line of questioning continued, to which the medical examiner responded, 'There's no force meter around Daniel Penny's arm, so I can't tell you how much pressure was applied.'" So that's some of the testimony from, again, the city and the prosecution's medical examiner. So there's kind of that admission, like, I don't know. I don't know how defense, much pressure was applied.
As you explain that, I'm hearing a sickle cell anemia possibility there. And then also maybe the synthetic, I guess it was like synthetic marijuana.
Yeah,
in the system,
I think synthetic marijuana is the way
now
to describe it.
Now you got the chokehold. So it sounds like defense is saying it may not have been the chokehold that took his life, but maybe the fact that, you know, he was loaded up or something, or had the sickle cell anemia situation. This is going to be interesting. And you're saying right now, the jury will look at this and they can have
I would expect by tomorrow or Thursday at the latest, we will have some sort of jury verdict on this. Now, Fox News pulled together kind of from the voir dire where they question the jurors to figure out who the attorneys want or don't want on that jury. They did a summary, and this was back at the beginning of the trial in October, and I went through the summary they did of all the jurors. And there's one in particular, but I'll give you some other characteristics of what we know about the people sitting on this jury. Juror number 10, a West Village, Manhattan, New York City woman. She herself had endured harassment on a near-empty subway car and said during the voir dire jury selection process that force could be justified under certain circumstances. So like an ordinary citizen trying to stop somebody else they see acting out of control or potentially acting in a criminal way. And despite her harrowing subway encounter, she said she did not call police, but she told the court that she and her friend were riding on a subway car in New York. They switched cars to get away from someone, a man acting erratically, who was swearing at them and calling them names. So now you've got some of these real-world experiences of people riding the trains in New York, and some of them have seen up close and personal some of these out-of-control situations where somebody can't control their impulses, and they're going to take those things into the jury box. So of the 12 jurors, 9 say they are regular subway riders. All of them have ridden the subway in the past, but 9 out of 12 are regular subway riders, and 7 out of those 12, according to this profile from Fox, had told the court during the voir dire process they had seen outbursts or altercations or erratic behavior that was in close proximity to them, and half of the jurors are women. And you tend to think that women might be a little bit more aware and concerned about these things than guys. Guys get on the subway or the light rail, and they think, okay, if someone acts out of control, at least I can probably begin to defend myself. For a woman, maybe not so easy. But so there's those distinctions. And, of course, you only need one juror to deadlock, and this trial is nullified. So I think that's going to be something to keep your eye on. You only need one juror, and I would anticipate there might be more than one based on the jury characteristics that I just went through with you that have already been known to the court and all the reporters.
And think about this, Phil, and as you're listening to KVI this morning, again, Phil and Mark in for John, who has the day off here, how many times over the years, not just with the situations we've had in recent years and people thinking, oh, I don't want to do this public transportation, but how many times on light rail, a metro bus, you've taken a ride. I commuted on the bus for many, many years before I moved to Hood Canal. There were times I'd sit and watch and question somebody thinking, okay, if something kicks in gear here and we have a situation on the bus, what would my part be as a citizen to keep other riders safe? And I've also had drivers on metro buses over the year, Phil, as you know, with some of the stations we work with and further parts of downtown Seattle, they would say, Mark, I'm not going to drop you off here. This is a questionable stop. I usually don't stop at this time in the morning or late at night because I have situations as a bus driver and have to take care of my bus. And they'd refuse to stop.
Driver discretion, exactly.
So we have that situation, and I'm sure we have stories. Perhaps you have one of an incident.
Let us know what you think about the Penny trial case. Text us at 206-421-5757. We'll get into the social media sweep coming up next. And then Lars Larson will join us, and we've got a couple of major stories to talk about with Lars coming up at 6:50, and then we'll get into more local stuff coming up after the top of the hour news at 7 o'clock. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, along with the radio legend Mark Christopher. We're sitting in for John Carlson just today. John will be back on tomorrow's show.
Digging deep for the stories and opinion to start your day. It's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
TV Tuesday here on the Community Carlson.
You wanted your TV theme Tuesday along with the holiday songs that we're starting to blend in here. We can do that, Phil.
We've been doing this thing where we start playing songs from the 60s in the 6 o'clock hour, 70s in the 7 o'clock hour, 80s and sometimes beyond in the 8 o'clock hour. Tuesday, TV themes. We need an occasional TV theme.
And who's the hero today? Everybody Giving Tuesday. All the charities are sending emails and phones. Careful, though. Watch out for the scams. But, again, they said the average person will donate around $175 to the charities of choice today on what's called Giving Tuesday.
Donate smartly, everybody. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, in for John this morning. John will be back tomorrow. Mark Christopher and I are in this morning here guiding the show to Markley Van Camp and Robbins here at 9:06 this morning. And it's time to do the social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Yesterday we were talking about Bernie Sanders tweeting out that he was, I think, in line with Elon Musk when it came to the audit of the Pentagon and the Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE. And somebody I follow on social media who's occasional talking head on like Fox Business News, her name's Carol Roth, and she was pointing out about the DOGE situation with the incoming Trump administration. The U.S. government took in around $5 trillion in the last fiscal year. That's more than the GDP of every country in the world other than the United States and China. And of course, you got to remember, the U.S. government, the federal government, takes in this $5 trillion, but states are also taking in their sales tax and their income tax. So it's not just that $5 trillion that is generated by the federal government. You have all the states that are generating billions of dollars as well. And Carol adds, we don't have a taxation or revenue problem. We have a government overspending problem. And that kind of just comes back to this whole ongoing process of, is the Trump administration going to be able to get their arms around trying to control government spending? I've got a story that we can get to a little bit later in the show, probably around 7:30. That's keeping track of the House majority for Republicans, because you have three Republicans in the House that are going to join the Trump administration. So they are going to ultimately have to get replaced in special elections. But if they're not part of the House majority come January 3rd or 6th or 20th, whenever the new Congress is sworn in, the Republicans are going to have to get by on just a one seat, potentially a one seat advantage, until those other special elections can take place to get new elected officials into those spots in the United States House. So that's another item that's coming up here as we sit in for John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Coming up next, you're going to hear from John because he had an excellent segment yesterday explaining what is going on with the rebels in Syria taking over the nation's second biggest city, what that's going to mean for Syria, what that's going to mean for Syria's neighbor, Israel, and, of course, arch enemy, Syria and Israel there. So we'll do that coming up next, and then Lars Larson will join us here on Talk Radio 570 KVI to round out the hour.
Melikilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day.
First trees cut, shipped to Hawaii almost 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
And just so you know, today in Oahu, they're planning for sunshine in 83. As we look out, still at darkness, waiting for sunrise, it's 35 degrees downtown Seattle.
Hawaii has 83, greater Seattle area. We have 38. We'll just invert that. Good morning, everybody. John Carlson's out today. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. Mark Christopher, the radio legend there. So we're holding down the show. And we got all kinds of stuff. We got two local stories we're going to get into, one from Tacoma, one from Redmond, to start the 7 o'clock hour. Lars Larson's going to be here in just a moment. On the text line, 206-421-5757, we had Lori and Puyallup that texted in for what we were talking about with the Daniel Penny New York City subway murder trial, essentially manslaughter trial of Jordan Neely. When Jordan Neely was acting out of control and Daniel Penny put him in a headlock and chokehold, and Jordan Neely ended up dying. Lori asked, hey, would Donald Trump be able to pardon Daniel Penny if he's found guilty? And she asked, or is it not a federal crime? It is not a federal crime. It is a state case. That's why it's happening in Superior Court in New York City, essentially. And so a federal crime, that's when a president can make that pardon. If it's a state crime, that's when a governor would make a pardon. So that's the distinction there. But I don't... No matter what happens in the case, I get a sensation that Donald Trump will be talking about whatever the outcome was. So thank you for that question on the text line, Lori.
Do you recall, just real quick, because we have so much here, has this ever happened in New York where they had a citizen?
You know, the one that I thought about this morning, because I knew we wanted to talk about this with the whole reason we're talking about Daniel Penny specifically this hour on the show is that the case is about to go to the jury. They're wrapping up closing arguments probably today. Later today, the jury could get the case, start deliberations, potentially have a verdict tomorrow, maybe the next day. The Bernard Goetz case. I was a little kid back in the early 80s when that happened.
Okay.
But I'd have to think back to the specifics on that because he was armed. And my recollection is that Bernard Goetz was armed and he ended up shooting somebody. And then there was, I think, some contention about was the crime suspect in retreat when Bernard Goetz ended up opening fire. I can't remember all the specifics. I'm sure some of the listeners will remember more of them than I do off the top of my head. But that was one where Goetz used a gun to defend himself. And at my recollection, he got acquitted. So they tried to bring him to trial, but he got acquitted anyway.
Okay.
All right. It's time for some geopolitics on the show.
I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
And we know you're not, Alexandria. But fortunately, we do know someone who is very astute on geopolitics. That's John Carlson. Syrian rebels have just taken over control of Syria's second largest city. That's Aleppo. Damascus is the biggest city in Syria. And Syria is a neighbor and enemy of Israel. So that's why I want you to hear John Carlson's explanation of what is happening right now in Syria.
The civil war that they have been fighting has resulted in, they estimate, between 610 and 620,000 people. So out of a population of 21 million, 620,000 are dead, and millions, over a million others have been hurt, wounded, injured. Just for a little bit of context here for you, the U.S. Civil War, we lost between 620,000, about the same number lost in Syria. The difference is that we had a population not of 21 million, but of over 31 million. And of course, the U.S. Civil War was the bloodiest war of our nation's history. No war even comes close. Even World War II, in a country that was close to three times as large as it was in 1860, had fewer fatalities than the U.S. Civil War. Well, the Syrian Civil War has more casualties than our Civil War, and the fighting goes on. Why does this matter to us? Well, that's a very good question because you can make a really good case that we shouldn't care who wins this. There's no good guy in the fight. You have the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who inherited the presidency from his father, Hafez al-Assad, who was known as a absolute ruthless butcher when he had to put down revolts and rebellions. He has had this war going since 2011. He is supported by Moscow. In fact, just over the weekend, Russian jets and Syrian fighter jets struck rebel-occupied areas over the weekend. Now, not only do you have Russia helping the Assad administration, you also have Iran. So you not only have Russia and Iran helping the Assad government in Syria. You also have Hezbollah, which is adjacent to, which is headquartered in Lebanon, which is adjacent to Syria, and of course is also immediately north of Israel. So, of course, if you have a regime supported by Hezbollah, Russia, and Iran, obviously you support the rebels, right? Well, not so fast. The rebel forces are led by a group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is abbreviated to HTS. HTS began as a group called Jabhat al-Nusra, an affiliate of al-Qaeda, the people who attacked us on 9/11. They are also very close to ISIS, the Islamic State. So are you for al-Qaeda and ISIS? Or are you for the Iranian, Russian, Hezbollah-backed government of Assad? Okay, yes, flip a coin. And keep flipping it, because the best thing for us to do is just to stand back and let what is happening and what has been going on for a long time continue to happen. There's no good dog in this fight. It's two rabid dogs fighting. There are good elements here and there, but the driving force trying to oust Assad and Assad himself are, in my view, barbarians. They're ruthless. They're homicidal. And just a reminder, you don't see Israel jumping into this war now, do you? You would think that Israel would have reason to do so. They're immediately south of Syria. But they are not, and I'll tell you why. Because Syria, which has attacked Israel several times during its existence, knows better than to start trouble with Israel. It would not end well for them, and they know it. When Israel sees Iran staging anti-Israeli raids or activities from within Syria, they will attack Syria. They will attack the Iranian militias or terror cells. So Israel just makes it clear, hey, don't mess with us. And Bashar Assad knows better than to do so. So does it matter that the second largest city in Syria, Aleppo, has now been taken over by the rebels? Yeah, it matters, because it does mean this war, which again has been going on since 2013, is going to continue.
There's John Carlson's segment from yesterday on the show, giving you that update about the circumstances in Syria. John's out this morning, but he'll be back tomorrow. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort, along with Mark Christopher. We're both sitting in covering for John this morning. Lars Larson's here. He's going to join us next. And a couple of different stories we want to talk to Lars Larson about, including one admission now from someone who tried to put together a 2020 film that was documenting that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, and that the filmmaker has now come out and said the 2020 film he put out was false.
Talk Radio 570, KVI, triggering the social justice warriors every chance we get.
Okay, Phil, I got word on this, and I know that this is important for a grandchild, for Lars. Apple TV Plus has all the rights to the Charlie Brown specials, whatever. They're going to unlock the subscription requirement Saturday the 14th, Saturday the 15th. They'll open up to all kinds of TV streaming so we can watch for free.
That is wonderful.
Isn't it great? Yeah.
And we say good morning to Lars. Lars Larson joining us here on the John Carlson Show. John's just out this morning. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John's producer, along with Mark Christopher and now Lars. And Lars, a couple of news items I want to cover with you. There was a 2000 presidential election film that was released by a writer, Dinesh D'Souza, pretty prolific conservative writer. And D'Souza has now had to publicly admit that his film 2000 Mules, which was claiming that there was fraud in the 2020 presidential election with Donald Trump and Joe Biden, he's now admitting that his debunked film, it was debunked by a lot of other experts, but it did include inaccurate evidence that were attempted to support his claim of voter fraud during the 2020 presidential election. D'Souza's released a statement on the website that he has and has apologized to someone from Atlanta that he identified as a so-called mule reportedly dropping off ballots to affect the outcome of the presidential election in the state of Georgia. And I know that you spoke
inaccurate
about
in identifying that man. I think the overall point, though, is that nobody can yet explain where the extra 12 million votes in 2020 came from, nor where they went this last election. All of a sudden, they appeared in 2020 to elect Joe Biden, and then they disappeared in 2024.
Yeah.
And despite D'Souza's bad research and bad presentation, the fact that the point remains, there was fraud in the 2020 election. And don't let people say, well, the fact that he admits part of his documentary was wrong in identifying this guy means that the whole idea is gone.
But to the effect that it had impacted or changed the outcome of the election, though, that's still not something that's going to be able to be validated. Now,
I still want to know where the 12 million votes went.
And then one other story, Lars. U.S. Senator from California, Alex Padilla, is telling, I think it was Face the Nation, that California is going to use taxpayer money for legal assistance, legal advice, and legal support for any illegal aliens or undocumented immigrants that are facing threats of deportation under a Trump administration.
Good. Then that makes it even easier for President Trump to cut them off from federal funds. He's already said he'll do it.
Based on
he
that?
He said if you get in the way of enforcing federal immigration law, which is only the job of the federal government, not the job of states, as Democrats have proved, including Obama in court, have proved, then we will simply take your federal funding away.
Goodbye. And, you've also got this complete likelihood that Washington and Oregon governors would follow suit with whatever
and
California decides to do, right?
They get chopped as well, and they deserve it. Yeah. They're disserving their own citizens by protecting criminal aliens.
Yeah, very good. You hear Lars Larson from noon to 3 here weekdays on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Have a great show. Thank you for your time this morning, Lars.
Thank you. And
Mark and I will continue in for John here. I've got a story, one from Tacoma, one from Redmond, that show the failures of public officials, elected officials here in the Puget Sound area for keeping things safe, for prioritizing first responders, and how that's costing you more just to live in the Puget Sound.
Phil, I was thinking about Giving Tuesday, the theme today, and people are like, I don't have a lot of money here. Mark said last hour, $175 average donation. You can donate time. Volunteer at school, volunteer in the community center. Yeah. That is value. They're saying here for 2024, after the day's end, $3.45 billion worldwide will be donated here to various charities. And like you said, watch out for the scams and some of those emails and
beware.
Cell phone notes you're getting today. But good for you for contributing.
Make Giving Tuesday fantastic for yourself as well. Hi, everybody. I'm Phil. I'm John's producer, Phil Vandervoort, sometimes known as Philip J. Vandervoort III. Mark Christopher, the radio legend right there. John's out today. He'll be back tomorrow. We'll do legendary lyrics tomorrow. But Mark and I are taking care of the show today in John's absence. Thank you for sticking with us. Thank you for joining us. Going to get into a couple of local stories, one out of Tacoma, one out of Redmond here in just a moment. And they kind of intersect. When you read between the lines, one of the other things I want to let you know about, Mark and I were having a conversation off the air in one of the breaks a little bit earlier. We realized we need to have a conversation about the latest episodes of the TV show Yellowstone. Between John, Mark, and me, we have all been watching this show, and it's, you know, it's tough in the age of so much streaming content and things like that to find shows that a whole lot of people are into and actively watching at the same time. Some people have to, oh, you know, I heard about that. Now I'll start watching it, but I'm 3-4 seasons behind or whatever. And so we're all up to date. We've all been watching Yellowstone, and Mark and I have noticed a couple of things, and we're going to have a little conversation about that. So we'll do that a little bit later this hour. But next hour on the show at 8:35, I want you to be here. We're going to have a couple of guests. They're going to help us kind of illustrate the failures of leadership in the Olympia legislature and Governor Inslee. And this revolves around the sales of recreational vehicles. So I'll kind of leave it a little cryptic at that point. If any of you are RV enthusiasts, you probably are already aware of a law that's coming down the pipe in 2025 and 2026 that's going to impact RV dealerships, RV sales. And like I said, it's all because of this mania that Governor Inslee has on stopping carbon emissions. It's kind of akin to his attempt to try and restrict and stop natural gas access, which voters reversed back in November on Initiative 2066. So we're going to get into that conversation at 8:35. I'd encourage you to join us so you can hear about this story because of what it exposes about the Olympia legislature and Governor Inslee and the control of Democrats in the Olympia legislature. But right now, Tacoma Fire Department is facing some budget cuts. Part of this revolves around a vote on the November ballot. Tacoma voters rejected a levy that would have increased taxes, but also would have helped fund the fire department in Tacoma. But this, there's a whole lot of moving parts to this, but the big thrust of this is that Tacoma's having budget problems. So Como 4 reporter Paul Rivera was at a press conference yesterday, and it was held by Tacoma Firefighters Union. And those union representatives were making the case that they are opposing budget cuts that would eliminate a rover team. And the rover team is kind of a small group of firefighters that can go from station to station and cover the shifts if people are sick, if people have vacation, stuff like that. So here's that report from Tacoma that the Tacoma Firefighters Union is trying to bring attention to.
Firefighters, they gathered to speak out about the conditions they're currently facing, saying they're overworked with a high call volume. They have failing equipment and response times are being affected as a result. They said industry practices say that response times should be 4 minutes 90% of the time. At the Tacoma Fire Department, though, it is taking them an average of 10 minutes to respond to your emergency.
10 minutes. For the fire department to show up if you've got a fire, you've got a medical emergency, something like that. And this 10-minute stretch is something that we'll kind of bring back up here at the end of the story.
The fire department is already $3.5 million over the budget. Now, an idea was to cut a rover program that allows 16 firefighters to fill in for others during sick and unplanned leave time. Those people wouldn't be let go. They would just be reassigned to other places, according to the city. The firefighters say they need that program to stay.
The city has kicked the can so far down the road with the budget that we truly are breaking. We truly are. Our people are breaking. Our apparatus are breaking. So, no, this doesn't stop. This doesn't stop the bleed. This doesn't make things better, but it just doesn't make things any worse than they already are.
All that said, but Councilmember Joe Bushnell tells Como that the most recent proposed budget increases the fire department's budget by $13 million. He said while they must invest in priorities like public safety, they also have to make tough choices because Tacoma is facing a projected $24 million deficit. But those I talked with in the fire department said the city has a spending problem and not a funding problem.
And so that spending problem is the entire budget, not as it relates per se to the fire department. So with this Como story, a couple of things jump out at me. First off, how about some basic transparency? Are we capable of that with our city council, elected officials. The city of Seattle's got a massive budget deficit they're dealing with. It looks like Tacoma has a pretty severe one as well, a $24 million budget deficit for the city of Tacoma. The state is going to have one that's going to be in the $10 to $12 billion range. So we're no stranger to this problem of budget deficits, budget problems. So how about some basic transparency, and specifically for this story in Tacoma, before you start cutting the priority stuff like first responders, fire department, firefighters, things like that, and before you start cutting the priority stuff like first responders and holding us hostage to your atrocious management skills, cut one of the extras. One of the extras like maybe a social justice program or two. And if you want me to get out the microscope, we can potentially do that. But this is why I asked for some basic transparency. And if you want to call yourself leaders, you don't complain about, hey, the fire department budget is short. No, you take care of that priority first. And then instead of holding us hostage for better fire department service and better firefighter staffing, then you come to us to say, hey, look, we'd really like to do this extra program, this social justice program. I don't know what's going on with DEI related stuff, how many DEI type hires they might have on the city of Tacoma payroll. But get those first priorities handled and then come to us and ask us for stuff like the social justice programs. And then let's put these priorities first. So that's the story from Tacoma. Now, there's another story that intersects with what's going on in Tacoma, and this comes out of Redmond, and it's a crime story in Redmond. And it's a crime story that Donald Trump could probably use to bolster his case for deportation of criminal illegal aliens and or mass deportations, depending on how far Donald Trump and the Republican majorities in the House and the Senate and Congress go. But this revolves around what Redmond police are calling a transnational crime ring. So you're going to hear some home security video of a break-in at a home in Redmond, and then Como's Michelle Esteban is going to narrate a little bit of that break-in video that you're going to hear.
You're watching what Redmond police describe as a residential burglary in progress. And what you don't see, Redmond Detective Sergeant Jesse Ballarood says, is even more concerning.
The suspects in this case specifically are tied to a larger transnational organized crime ring.
Ballarood has tracked about a dozen residential burglaries in Redmond this year alone, all after homeowners' jewelry and cash.
So what they're looking is for easy targets, people that they believe would have large amounts of cash, large amounts of jewelry.
The homeowner got an alert from their security system that their back door was open. They checked their surveillance video and saw this. They called police. Redmond PD says they found the suspect's car abandoned a few miles away near this field. And in the tall grass, they found the couple's jewelry, luxury watches, gold, and gem pieces. That car eventually led to the arrest of these two men, now charged with residential burglary. And the victims, they got their jewelry back.
So some good news, bad news there. The people whose home was broken into, luckily they are able to recover what was stolen. So there's the plus side of the story. Now, the negative, the drawback of all this, is that the Como story reports that two suspects have been arrested. I don't know what the charging status is, but there's no apparent information based on these suspects. They've got mugshots of them. There's no indication about, are they citizens of the United States? Are they resident aliens? Are they illegal aliens? What's their residency citizenship status? And if it's applicable, what would be their country of origin status? Like I said, if that's applicable. And I'll tell you why I'm going to point that out or ask that question here in just a moment. But there's one more part of the story that includes another comment from Redmond police sergeant. And this is the part of the story where Como says these home break-ins have become so acute in Redmond that they're putting together a broader investigative group For this transnational crime ring.
Redmond PD has now formed a task force to work solely on such cases.
So between the myself and some of the other jurisdictions that as we've gotten together, we do have several hundred instances that are kind of tied to this larger transnational organized crime group.
So several hundred cases, several hundred investigations, and all the information seems to point to a transnational crime ring. That's the word from the Redmond Police Department sergeant who's handling this task force. So I just told you about the Tacoma story, now this Redmond story. Both of these stories jack up your homeowners or your rental insurance premiums. And these are policy decisions that have come from elected officials in Redmond, elected officials in Tacoma, and you can pick the other suburban cities. Like Bellevue, Issaquah, Sammamish, Kirkland, Woodinville, the King County Council that have contributed to this. The decisions that are made in the state legislature and Governor Inslee all play into how a transnational crime ring ends up having, what did the Redmond police sergeant say, a couple hundred investigations of cases that seem to be linked. So I wanted to try and get some possible perspective on this. We've talked about some of these transnational crime ring stories on John Carlson's show before. John's out this morning. I'm his show producer, Phil Vandervoort, sitting in for John. So we've talked about them in other parts of King County, South King County, things like that. Right now, the focus is on Redmond based on this new Como 4 story about this task force. So I thought, okay, transnational crime ring, that to me sounds like people are organizing in a country outside the United States. And we've heard in the northern part of South America, Colombia could be one of the locations or suspected locations of where some of these transnational crime rings might be run out of, potentially Central America countries as well. So you've got that factor. Why would Washington be a place where so many of these transnational crime ring cases might be happening that the Redmond Police Department would decide, you know what, we better put together a task force on this? Is it because Washington is a sanctuary state? Is it because Washington has relaxed its laws and soft on crime policies that Democrats in the legislature in Olympia and Jay Inslee have imposed on us the last few years that have backfired, that have not worked, that have not delivered what they promised to try and fix crime? Is this happening in Oregon? Is this happening in California? I contacted Kirby Wilbur, who has been the longtime KVI talk show host here. He is retired to Texas. I asked Kirby, I was like, hey, man, we've got numerous reports about these transnational crime rings operating in Seattle or the Seattle area. I'll be more generic. And I asked Kirby, I was like, do you ever come across stories of towns or cities or jurisdictions in Texas where there are transnational crime rings operating, like I'm talking about with what happened in Redmond, where it's home break-ins? I'm sure that there probably are as it relates to drug distribution rings and human trafficking. We'll set those two big ticket items aside for the time being. But is this a situation where transnational crime rings are like, well, you know, if we decide to start targeting crimes in the state of Washington, our chances of running into any resistance are lower than they would be in this state, Texas, this state, Arizona, this state, Oklahoma. Take your pick of more Republican-leaning states. So that's why I wanted to single out these two stories, because A, transnational crime ring, if this is where they decide to operate, this is costing you more as a renter, as a homeowner in your insurance premiums. That makes it more expensive to live here. Same for the situation in Tacoma. If the city of Tacoma can't figure out its firefighter staffing and it takes them 10 minutes to respond to a fire at peak times, that's going to end up costing you more in homeowners insurance. That's what the actuaries at the insurance company are going to be looking at for how much it's going to cost you to replace what got damaged in a fire. And then one other story about this is that Donald Trump and his staff taking over the presidency, they should be looking at this Redmond story and this task force for a transnational crime ring. And they should be using that as a national example of why this country needs some serious immigration reform plans, needs to deal with criminal illegal aliens. And this is the practical example that would illustrate what needs to happen as it relates to stopping criminal illegal aliens and what the Trump administration could be doing about that. So that's why I wanted to bring up those stories and present them to you in this light here with John Carlson out this morning on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Now, if you've got some thoughts or reaction to this, you can text us on the KVI text line 206-421-5757. I'll be picking up the texts here, 206-421-5757. In for John Carlson this morning. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, is with me.
Checking the pulse of politics every hour on the commute with Carlson. It's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
It's fun to stay at the
Doing the Trump dance?
Do we have a little, real quick before we get to social media, a little follow-up? Okay. You had that story here over a week ago or so with the Donald Trump shuffle using this song.
Right, yeah.
All right. Well, everybody's been asking, you know, rights to the song, how many songs are on the list now that they're saying Trump can't use it. For the record, founding member Victor Willis, who supported Kamala Harris in this year's presidential election, says he has no problem for Trump to use the song. He went on to say he didn't have the heart to call the campaign and tell Donald Trump to quit using it here. He did obtain, Donald Trump and his people obtained the licensing from BMI, which a lot of radio stations have to have. So he's paying the fees.
Pay the royalties.
Also, Victor Willis, one of the founding members of the disco group Village People, says since he's been using the song, it's estimated to be grossing several millions of dollars for the group and surviving members. So Merry Christmas.
All right. The Trump economy, reviving songs to make them valuable again, I guess. All righty. But we've kind of got a developing situation in Seoul, South Korea. I had noticed something about this a little earlier in the hour and didn't have a chance to find many specifics. But one of the KVI texters, let's see, Mike in Kirkland, texted in to say, hey, what's going on in South Korea? And the short answer is that the prime minister, I'm trying to double check if that's the, it's the president, South Korean president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has declared martial law. And apparently some of this stems from, he is a conservative. He took office in 2022, but the National Assembly is controlled by the opposition party. And I'm looking at a post now on social media from the Wall Street Journal, and it's, you know, pretty basic. It says that the South Korean president declared martial law, telling his country in a televised address first thing our time today that opposition parties made the country vulnerable to North Korean communist forces. And so this seems to be either a power play between the president and the National Assembly or people that are within the control of the National Assembly, which is the opposing political party to the president of South Korea. So, fine question from Mike in Kirkland. I had noticed something about that. That's kind of the initial report. I suspect we'll get more updates at the top of the hour here as we hit those updates on Talk Radio 570 KVI. John Carlson's out this morning. I'm Phil Vandervoort, his producer. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, along with me. The Social Media Sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino. And a lengthy post from the Senate Republicans down in the Olympia Legislature. And it was a message that was posted by Senator Linda Wilson, a Republican state senator. She's from the Camas, Washougal, Skamania County area there between Clark County and Skamania County, representing that portion of Washington in the state legislature. And she was writing about access to natural gas and how all this revolves around the vote on Initiative 2066 that passed and restored choice for natural gas and new construction of homes, apartments, businesses, restaurants, things like that. And she's writing that the State Building Code Council, which she is a former ex officio member of, but the State Building Code Council, she wrote, I am not confident that a majority of the voting members on that council give a hoot that a majority of the Washington voters supported Initiative 2066, protecting access to natural gas. She writes, the governor, Jay Inslee, appoints the voting members of this state building code council, and the outgoing governor made sure to pack that current group with people who share his hatred of natural gas. That's why the council already changed Washington's energy code to prohibit the use of natural gas in new commercial construction and restrict the use of gas in new residential construction. But of course, I 2066 passed. She writes, the public policy choice is simple. Will the state building code council cling to its anti-natural gas position? Or will they follow the will of the 1.93 million voters who repealed what was known as House Bill 1589 with the passage of 2066? She writes, keep in mind that this ban on natural gas that was set in motion set a course for the forced electrification of homes, which would cost millions of homeowners as much as $70,000 to replace gas appliances and use electric versions instead. And as many people north and east of Seattle were just reminded with our windstorm, our state's power grid has enough reliability issues already. So she is writing that this coming, Friday. Yes, Friday. She writes, Inslee's allies are expected to sue to overturn I-2066 once the measure takes effect, which is December 5th, this Friday, when the election results must be certified by the state. She says, stay tuned. This is all going to get even more complicated. In the meantime, if you appreciate having natural gas as a choice, the passage of I-2066 is another reason to be thankful this Thanksgiving season. So important message there. And this week, December 5th, Friday, we're going to get more information about what happens with the fate of natural gas access in the state of Washington. All righty. So, like I said, Mark and I are sitting in for John this morning. The Yellowstone conversation. Did you see this Chevy trucks commercial? I saw this a lot over the Thanksgiving break that I had watching ball games and things like that. An excellent commercial. We might have to play and talk about some of that. And then at 8:35, our conversation about electric vehicle RVs and a new state law that is coming that might change around what type of RV you can buy in the state of Washington.
Live, local, letting the establishment have it. Lars Larson, weekdays noon to 3, KVI, KVI.com.
There's sunshine coming later on, Phil. Are you everybody. Sure? It's going to be nice. Giving Tuesday. Make donation, your favorite donations, favorite cause, volunteer time. In my life, public television, all the work I did at KCTS9, one comes to mind. And a lot of companies are matching donations to Phil.
Check your company, right? So you check make with
a,
HR.
Yeah, like $50 donation maybe to Medic One. They may have a program, but they'll double it. Medic One's another one that comes to mind, too. But again, Giving Tuesday, everybody just asked to make donations to all your favorite causes here. And thank you for your donations. So.
John Carlson's out this morning. There's Mark Christopher, the radio legend. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John's producer. John will be back tomorrow. We'll do legendary lyrics on tomorrow's show, but Mark and I are running the show this morning. So thank you for being with us. Thank you for sticking with us. We want to talk about the story out of Federal Way. It's a murder cold case that was finally solved with DNA after 36 years. And I had noticed this story, but a couple of different outlets are posting and reporting on this story in Seattle. Channel 7 TV posted a short summary. It says, back in 1988, August of 1988, Federal Way young woman, I think she was 18 or 19, something
18,
like that.
18 years old.
Her name was Tracy Whitney. She disappeared. Her body was found near the Puyallup River, or at the Puyallup River near Sumner, by fishermen. They had some suspicions about maybe who might have killed her. They were never able to bring a case. They've used DNA now and have figured out who was responsible for her murder, or at least whose DNA was at the scene and on the body after this woman was killed. And so 2 months after her body was discovered, they actually had to use dental records to identify Tracy Jean Whitney. Her last known location in 1988 was at the Burger King in Federal Way. I'm going to guess that's the one that's been on 320th Street.
Yeah, it's one that's been in the news a lot with different things going on.
I grew up in Tacoma, but had a friend that lived in Federal Way. Mm-hmm. And there was a great arcade at the old SeaTac Mall. They call it the Commons, but the old SeaTac Mall. And so we would run up to Federal Way from time to time. And I was 18 years old mm-hmm. in 1988. I was at that Burger King. And this is just bizarre to think of this convergence that, you know, as a young person years ago, you may have been crossing paths with someone who met this horrible fate of being killed, murdered, and then having an unsolved case. So during the investigation, police spoke with multiple suspects, according to the Cairo 7 story, including Whitney's friends, an ex-boyfriend. And at one point, an ex-boyfriend was a person of interest, but nothing was ever pursued from a criminal investigation standpoint. So back in 2005, a DNA profile, the suspect, or DNA from the scene, was uploaded into a database.
Yeah, you want to hear the actual steps of how this came about?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, because Phil brought this up, because I brought it to John and Phil's attention. You're going into Thanksgiving, they brought this up. And think about it, and Phil reminded me here, 1988, we were still working on solving Green River Task Force.
Yeah, that's
the Green River Task Force was still active. Reduced
unsolved.
Yep, they were still working on it. Of course, we were just around the time of Ted Bundy, you know.
Not too far after that, yeah.
Right, and going to prison there in Florida. And then, of course, the death penalty and the outcome of that whole thing. But what was interesting about this, like Phil said, 18-year-old Tracy Whitney, a Federal Way, she was at the Burger King. The story was that was the last place she was seen. People remember she was in an argument with her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. 24 hours later, like you said, she was found there in the river where, like, the White River and the Puyallup River kind of meet together there in the Sumner area. Mm-hmm. Detectives, of course, started working. I'm sure at that time in 1988, maybe working with some of the task force of Green River, saying, we got to figure this out. Is it another victim of Green River Killer? Darren Moss, Pierce County spokesperson here in PIO, basically, you see him a lot in TV news, shares right here basically what they had here back in 1988.
Some fishermen had located the body of a woman who was nude right where the Puyallup and White Rivers meet. Detectives were called out to the scene, but had no information on the identity of the woman. An autopsy was performed and revealed the woman's cause of death was asphyxia caused by strangulation and probable smothering. She had several blunt force injuries and was believed to have been sexually assaulted. Her death was ruled a homicide, and DNA swabs taken from the body came back positive for semen.
And you were saying too, Phil, right away we think, well, it's got to be the boyfriend or some kind of an argument there at the Burger King earlier, 24 hours earlier. Or
circumstantial,
maybe,
but sure, right?
Most of the time, you know, most detectives will tell you it's usually right off the bat related to somebody in the family, maybe a neighbor, somebody at school, maybe even somebody at work. You said the dental records 2 months after the body was found did identify that it was indeed 18-year-old Tracy Whitney. So here we are 36 years later. Now let's get into what Detective Lindsay Kirkgaard of Pierce County brings us here in the case and where it stands and maybe even some struggles. Would it link that DNA back to the boyfriend at the Burger King?
2021, now retired Detective Sergeant Linnell Anderson looked into Tracy's case again as a possible candidate for a grant application through the Washington State Attorney General's office. In 2005, a DNA profile of the suspect was uploaded to CODIS. CODIS stands for Combined DNA Index System, which is maintained by the FBI. Given the technological limitations and changes of that time period, it was decided to resubmit Tracy's swabs to take advantage of the newer, more advanced technology available at the Washington State Crime Lab. The new DNA profile that was obtained was uploaded into CODIS. Unfortunately, there were no matches. In March of 2022, retired Detective Sergeant Anderson sent the DNA extract to Parabon Labs for forensic genetic genealogy. Family lines were traced back to the 1700s. Once a family tree was constructed, the results came back to John Guillot Jr. Unfortunately, John died of cancer in January 2022, 8 months prior to receiving the results. He had also been cremated, so there was no DNA to compare to the suspect DNA profile.
So that's where it stands. Now, this is a suspect, this John
So this
Gio,
is a different person altogether.
Yes, he was not the boyfriend that she had an argument with at the Burger King. John Guillot of Puyallup, a suspect on this, and somehow they linked him, maybe possibly involved, but then over time they said there's nothing connecting. So now they stand as to, okay, we go through all the relatives. How do you go back to the 1800s here in the genetics here to try to find a match in DNA. Once again, we continue here with Detective Lindsay Kirkgaard.
Retired Detective Sergeant Anderson reached out to the Washington State Patrol and learned that they could confirm the identity by using other family members' DNA as comparison. Detectives discovered that John had a son that had also recently died. They were able to obtain his DNA from the medical examiner's office. The son's DNA was then compared to the male DNA obtained from Tracy's body. The results confirmed that the DNA was not John Guillot III, but that John Guillot III was a biological child of the male profile. This confirmed that the male profile belonged to John Guillot Jr. Because of this, John Guillot Jr. was determined to be the suspect in this case.
Again, he died 2 weeks before all this came about here. And then again, what was the connection to this 18-year-old here, Tracy Whitney, there 36 years ago? Again, Sergeant Kirkgaard explains.
Throughout the investigation, any evidence within the case, nothing suggested that Tracy was familiar to John in any way. This led detectives to believe that this case was a stranger abduction, rape, and murder.
Total stranger. No connection to family, friends, the boyfriend whatsoever, but the DNA, again, going through the history of the family, the genetics, finding out that the suspect had a son. They confirmed that there was some link to the DNA in the son that led back to the father with, again, the suspect they announced who became the murderer, they say, with all the proof, is John Gill of Puyallup. And I was telling Phil this morning right now, police in Boulder, Colorado say new tips may help officials move closer to solving the violent murder of six-year-old JonBenet Ramsey. That's been about 30 years right now. So to say progress being made in the investigation of the six-year-old's killing. Sources close to the investigation say a team of experts is going through remaining evidence using modern scientific and cold case techniques to try and crack the case. Right away, it was a big red flag thinking they got to be looking at the same techniques that Pierce County Sheriff's Department was looking at here and to solve the murder 36 years ago of 18-year-old
Tracy
Whitney here. So we'll see what happens on that. But again, there's such connection to this, Phil, as you know, and everybody in the Northwest, because of the fact we got on the map, sadly, because of, you know, the Ted Bundy situations going on here, and also with Gary Ridgway and the Green River killings we had, again, going through the 1980s or whatever. But just the technology and the Washington State Patrol and all the detectives from various counties, and it was before... you know, not until the Green River Killer investigations, even, you know, looking at a Ted Bundy, a lot of law enforcement never shared information. And a lot of, and I have a lot of connection.
Databases and things like that.
And I have a lot of connection to the Green River Task Force. I was one of the first in music saying, have you guys ever looked at the song Green River? You know, I mean, how many crimes we've had linked to songs? And they said, Mark, we already had that on the list. But it was interesting, and very few people know this, with the Green River Task Force and trying to figure out the killings there. And eventually, of course, we hear Gary Ridgway announced there in late 2007, 2008, what have you, 1,500 so-called serial crimes, you know, just imagine, were solved by the task force because of what they assembled here, connecting with all the different law enforcement agencies in trying to find a killer of all these Green River murders. Yeah. But a lot of people never heard that. 1,500 different serial crimes around the state, around the Northwest, were solved because of that task force.
What a key factor that has become. And the Cairo 7 story says that Tracy Whitney's sister, Robin, says the family is happy to now finally get some information to bring some closure here. They want to continue to try and figure out ways to honor Tracy's memory, and they're hopeful that the DNA may potentially lead to information about other unsolved cases connected to this guy that is now implicated in the kidnapping and murder of their sibling, their sister. So that was a staggering story, and considering all the circumstances of the time elapsed to finally be able to get DNA and the matches and the sleuthing and the extra effort. And I mean, the story even said one detective came out of retirement essentially to try and work on this as a cold case. Just the amount of human hours that were put into it are remarkable, and hopefully now, thankfully for this family, at least they have some understanding of what happened. Well, Mark, Christopher, and I'm Phil Vandervoort, sitting in for John Carlson this morning. We still got lots to cover in the next hour and 20 minutes on the show. Stick with us. Coming up at 8:35, we're going to get into an interview with an RV dealer out in Monroe. They've got two locations, one in Monroe, one in Arlington. But Governor Inslee is imposing a law in the state of Washington that is mirrored from a law in California. And it's going to put a drastic impact on the sales of recreational vehicles in the state. And it's all in the name of reducing carbon emissions. We'll talk to the RV dealership manager and an attorney. There's bound to be a lawsuit about this new law that's going into effect at the behest of Governor Inslee. So we'll get into that. You'll figure out, you'll tell us if you think this is just a foolish law or if this actually has some merit. So that's something we'll do at 8:35. And then we've got more to get into as well about the mass deportation plan for Donald Trump. Turn this into a sporting contest. Okay. Phil Vandervoort, I'm John Carlson's producer, in for John this morning. John will be back tomorrow. We'll do Wednesday Legendary Lyrics on tomorrow's show. Mark Christopher, the radio legend, here with me as well. Next hour, we'll get into a little bit more of what's going on with South Korea. Martial law has been imposed there. We kind of had this breaking news story coming in the last hour of the show. We'll try and get a little bit more perspective on that. We got to talk about Donald Trump really only has one shot to get this deportation, mass deportation or deportation of illegal aliens, criminal illegal aliens done. We'll get into some of that. We're going to talk about this state law that's going to go into effect in a year or so that will basically ban gasoline, diesel-powered new RV sales and what that's going to mean for RV dealers here in our state. One other story I want to bring you up to date on about Congress. The House of Representatives back in Washington, D.C., the Republicans are going to have control, but it might only be a one-seat majority when Trump actually takes the oath of office. Fox News story says House Republicans could begin the new year grappling with a one-seat majority in the House, that perilously slim margin for the next Congress, and it would work out for at least the first 100 days or so of Donald Trump's administration, Donald Trump's presidency. It revolves around some of the people Donald Trump has appointed to his cabinet. Elise Stefanik is one. Mike Walz. Walz is a congressman from Florida as a national security advisor. Matt Gaetz, of course, had to resign, even though he won an election. They're going to have to figure out what happens with that seat. And so until those special elections to replace those already represented congressional members, it means that the Republican majority could be just a single vote for the first couple of months of the Donald Trump term. So another race revolves around a district in California where an incumbent Republican is trailing ever so slightly to a Democratic challenger. They're probably going to have a recount, runoff, sort of recount of that. And so that's another seat that could give the Democrats one more seat in the U.S. House. So now you're up to date on where that will be for the first part of the Trump administration. Stick around. A whole lot more to jam in here on The Commute with Carlson on this Tuesday, up next on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Morning, everybody around Puget Sound and beyond, listening to us on KVI.com, our streaming. I'm Phil Vandervoort, John Carlson's producer, along with Mark Christopher, the radio legend. John's out for today. He'll be back for tomorrow. We'll do Legendary Lyrics tomorrow and give you a great prize or two, depending on what we've got in the stash. We'll do that. And then John will take a couple days off at the end of the week. He's going to take off Thursday and Friday. Ari Hoffman will be here with me on Thursday and Friday. So that's a little bit of the upcoming schedule and the today schedule, but thanks for joining in. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Mark and I are going to talk to a couple of guests about a state law that's going to be coming in another year or so, and it has to do with the restriction of gas and diesel-powered vehicles in this state. And specifically, it has to do with the sales of recreational vehicles. And the only RVs that are going to be able to be sold in the state that are new are going to be EVs. We'll try and explain what this law is supposed to do, but we'll also talk to a manager of a Monroe RV dealership about what the practical impact is going to be for all of the RV dealers here in the state of Washington, because it could mean a lot of them end up just shutting down. Well, we'll get into more specifics about that at 8:35. We'll find out how extensive this might get. There's also going to be some lawsuits over this, so we can kind of get you apprised of that situation. Earlier in the show, we were talking about this developing story out of South Korea. South Korea's president has imposed martial law in the nation. And there was some of the background of this revolves around, you've got a conservative South Korean president, you've got a more liberal National Assembly, and the martial law declaration was made, according to the president of South Korea, based on some reports about the National Assembly possibly allowing some vulnerabilities to the nation from North Korea. There were concerns about communist infiltration. I'm looking at a couple of different posts of video that people have made where uniformed soldiers are essentially trying to secure the National Assembly and are in confrontations with people inside the National Assembly. Sky News has one video, says breaking television footage shows South Korea troops enter the main parliament hall. It comes after the South Korean president declared martial law across the country in a surprise television address. Would have been late Tuesday on South Korean time. Of course, that's first thing in the morning for us here on the west coast of the United States. One other post, let me see what this guy's social media profile says. It says, co-host of Breaking Points with Crystal and Cigar. His name is Cigar and Jetty. 450,000 followers. But Cigar and Jetty posted about the United States and South Korea. He writes, South Korea is the U.S.'s sixth largest trading partner, double what America does with trade to France. But look at the institutional knowledge in media experts on cable casts, cable shows, news, legacy news, media outlets on what's going on in South Korea right now versus Europe. We pay so little attention to Asia when our destiny is determined there. And it's a great reminder about the scope and influence of South Korea's economy, the Asian economy, and the United States compared to Europe. We tend to know a whole lot more about what's going on in European politics than we do South Korean politics. So that's the newest information I'm able to find. But this is going to be an ongoing situation, I'm guessing, for at least 24 hours while things get sorted out in South Korea. So let's bring you, let's provide you that update. I wanted to talk about Donald Trump and the mass deportation question. And this kind of keeps coming up in different forms and different news stories and political reaction and things like that. And I came across a Politico story that does a pretty decent job of laying out what we'll call them the pros and the cons. You know, you're going to get some rewards. You're going to get some drawbacks depending on how far Donald Trump and the Republicans in the House, Republicans in the Senate with those slim majorities, how far they want to push for immigration reform, border security, a border wall, and the deportation stuff. And so I just kind of want to start off with some general thoughts that for Trump, you're really only going to have one chance to handle any sort of deportation program. Trump, the Trump lawyers, the entire administration officials that are dealing with the border security, immigration, legal and illegal immigration, and the deportation question are really going to have to think this through meticulously because activists and Democrats are going to sue. Obviously, you've got the Senate that has the filibuster that Democrats would be able to use to roadblock whatever the Republicans might be able to come up with. So that's why I'm saying you really only have one chance to handle this and sort this out, and you've got to meticulously go through what you can and can't do, what you can accomplish and what you can't accomplish, and what that's going to mean to your political capital, where you want to put your political focus. So I'll tell you right now, activists and Democrats are going to sue. They're going to try and delay this or stop this in court. Team Trump has to have a legally and politically workable plan, whatever they do. And I'm primarily talking about the deportation stuff. And if you try to overreach on deportations, it could end up erasing all the political ground that Trump and the Republicans have made as Democrats have been in this free fall, even though they've gotten all this free publicity from legacy news outlets. So I'm talking about taking back over the Senate in the 2024 election and having a majority in the House. So given all that, I want to go through a little bit of what this Politico story says. I'll try and skim back up here to the headline. Yeah, it says, why the House GOP's big immigration crackdown may be doomed. All right, predictable from the kind of Democratic Party default media. But there are a couple of passages in this Politico story that I think are illuminating that kind of help give you a little understanding of what direction this may go. And kind of the, like I said, the political capital, the costs that you want to absorb to try and get something accomplished. They write, there are some immigration issues that unite Republicans as they plan for 2025 and beyond. Based on interviews with roughly a dozen GOP lawmakers, when it comes to budget reconciliation and sidestepping the Senate filibuster, they believe they have a shot at enacting more funding for the border wall, border technology, and related personnel to enforce things at the border. They're also looking at ideas like taxing money that individuals in the United States send to individuals in other countries. I think that was something that Trump had alluded to when he said in Mexico is going to pay for it. I think that was one of the allusions rather than the more direct Mexico cuts a check to the United States, which a lot of Democrats seized on and tried to criticize Trump for. And the Politico story says after that, things get trickier. House Republicans, including moderates from swing districts, are expected to try to quickly pass a party line immigration bill. The current legislation, known as H.R. 2, would most likely be a messaging exercise and would be blocked in the Senate. So Republicans spent months last year negotiating this particular H.R. 2, which cracks down on asylum and requires the border wall to be built. I think John mentioned this on maybe yesterday's show or maybe it was late last week, that the Remain in Mexico policy Trump had enacted, Biden repealed, that applies to asylum seekers. If you're getting to the United States border and you're saying, hey, I want asylum because the my country of origin, I would be in danger there, it would require them to remain in the country at the U.S. border, in this case, Mexico. So the Politico story says that the House Judiciary Chair Jim Jordan from Ohio wants to try and include some of the more dramatic changes in the reconciliation package. And this would allow the House plan to get around some of the Senate filibuster if they tie some of this to budgetary stuff. And that's what they talk about with reconciliation. It revolves around what gets put into the budget that the House and Senate would ultimately have to agree on rather than a standalone bill. So an effort that would potentially run afoul of budgetary rules for the procedure, Politico writes, setting up a clash with the Senate parliamentarian who enforces these restrictions. Under budget reconciliation restrictions, policies can only be included if they meet a series of rules, including that their budgetary impact has to outweigh their policy impact. And it says Trump is expected to enact some of those ideas through executive orders, but without Congress, they can be undone by a succeeding administration, kind of like the Remain in Mexico stuff was. So there's a little bit of perspective of what the Republicans are up against and how far they're going to want to go and what they can do to try and apply some pressure, because this is the other part of the equation. They're going to have to apply some pressure on the Democrats, particularly moderate Democrats, to advance any sort of reforms or any sort of plans. But the mass deportation question is going to be a particularly thorny one because, you know, Democrats are going to put up a hue and a cry for repatriating people that are in this country illegally back to their home country. And, you know, that's what I talk about with Trump and the lawyers and being meticulous about this. They're going to have to think of all these little minutia possibilities of what happens if a country of origin won't take back someone. So they're going to have to figure out ways to get some checks and balances going, obviously create some pressure on any of these home countries to take back and repatriate people that are in this country illegally. So there's a kind of an overview, but one of the things I just kind of wanted to put out there for you is that as complex and as many moving parts there are to this possibility of a deportation plan, even if it just focuses specifically on criminal illegal aliens, if this is going to work, if this is going to be effective in any way, they're going to have to be incredibly organized with how they put together a plan going forward and get buy-in from just enough Democrats. I mean, you're not going to satisfy all the Democrats all the time. That's simply not in the works. But if you can pick off a couple that would end up crossing over to support immigration reform, deportation stuff, border security stuff, that's where the focus has to be so that you can really get some momentum going on this. Otherwise, we're just going to be stuck with the continual status quo. Democrats block what Republicans do. Republicans block what Democrats want to do. And we're just going to be stuck with the same ineffectual, broken, ruinous situation. And so that's the other side of this is you just get stuck with the status quo. Mark and I have been talking about the TV show Yellowstone a lot over the last couple of years. We've talked about it on the air with John. They've just got new episodes that have come out. And they're trying to basically wrap up a fifth season. This is the second half of the fifth season. And they're really kind of getting to the end of some of these storylines. They're going to have to make some decisions. Do they want the show to go on? I don't want to give away any spoiler alerts
and
here.
And we won't. We promise.
And I'm a couple of episodes behind on the news. So I've seen a couple of episodes of the new season. And I'm a bit confused because it seems like they're sort of telling the storyline out of order. But they're not telling you in any specific way on the screen.
Right.
This happened 2 months earlier.
Yeah, and think about it.
This happened 1 year earlier.
And think about it. When we started season 5 of Yellowstone, which number one TV show. Yeah. I mean, we had over 16 million viewers there when they brought back a new episode here as they continue what they now call season 5 part 2. But it's been since 2022. And then we heard, of course, Kevin Costner, and, executive producer, I know I am, and John Dutton, the third, you know, lead role. But I've got other interests, so I'm going to jump away. So Taylor Sheridan even kind of kept Costner out of
the
whole thing.
He's the show creator.
Yeah.
Sheridan.
And when they brought it back and had the first episode air again, it would be episode number 9 here a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, this season.
Mm-hmm. Costner didn't even watch it. Taylor said nothing to Costner what it's about until the following Monday morning after it aired. Yeah. And I won't even say what the conversation was, but Costner was like, okay. So now we just had number 12. We've got 13 of season 5, part 2 airing this Sunday. The following Sunday will be the 14th episode, and that's it. But gut feeling is, will Taylor Sheridan even just leave this thing alone, or maybe years from now, return to Yellowstone? Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Or there'll be a spinoff, maybe.
Right. But what's great about it, of course, all the cast members are just hush-hush about it. You can't hear anything about these episodes here as we continue what will be the final episodes here as we get through the rest of part 2 of season 5. But many of the actors involved with the show are very generous in sharing how it came to be that they were on the show, the fun that they're having, the people they get to meet. One of which who's been very quiet is Jen Landon. If you don't watch the show, or if you watch the show, daughter of TV longtime personality, of course, Michael Landon.
No kidding. Oh, I hadn't realized this.
Yeah.
And she's one of the ranch hands at the Yellowstone Ranch.
Right. And it was Taylor Sheridan thinking, I need to do something here to kind of beef things up here. It's at a time that if you watch the episodes here, like 2021, we want to add a new ranch hand. But what do we do? So he thought maybe there's a role here to bring in a female. So Jen Landon had a role. What a name, what a character. Here's how she was brought into the show.
Falling and dragging since I could bounce for a...
That ain't Spanish, she's Texan.
Ain't Texan? That's gibberish.
No, I'm telling you, it's Texan. It's smelling a mile away. What's your name?
Taylor.
What's that?
You? And she said Peter.
Tate Turk.
Yeah, Tate Turk.
No, so she has this incredibly specific accent, or drawl, whatever you want to call it. So she... You have to listen super closely to what she says.
Yeah, you got to rewind it. One reason everybody watches the episode more than twice, maybe even three times. So Jen Landon, you wonder, okay, well, yeah, Michael Landon, she's a, oh, yeah, get her, throw her in. Not so easy. Jen Landon explains here how it all came to be, and you want to talk about coincidence and timing and just being at the right place at the right time. This is how she became Teeter on Yellowstone.
I had been working as an actor for like 10 years and I just didn't want to do it anymore and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I basically packed up my life and I left a relationship and I left my house and I left a career. I walked away from it completely and I didn't really know where I was going to go. I ended up living on a cattle ranch in Paradise Valley, Montana. So it was synchronistic when 5 years later I ended up playing a young woman who lives on a cattle ranch in Paradise Valley, Montana.
Is that bizarre?
Life imitating art,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Had nothing to do with being the daughter of Michael Landon. The other one I want to play real quick, too, here, and this was a great thing, was one named Ian Bowen. If you watch the show, he's a longtime ranch hand of the Yellowstone named Ryan. And Taylor Sheridan, creator, writer, says, you know, there's something I want to add here for Ryan, who's just on the verge of being one of the more popular ranch hands there, because often when Rip is
the main ranch hand, he runs the ranch.
Needs somebody.
Doesn't own the ranch. He runs the ranch.
Yeah, he'll need somebody to take over. He goes for a younger one, so he goes for the character Ryan. But Ian Bowen explains here a little highlight that he had here at the start of season 5, and it involved a girl.
Taylor called me in early days, and he said, "Hey, I've got a girlfriend for you." And I said, "Oh my, thank God, this is going to be great. Tell me all about her." And he said, "On the show."
Yes, for the show
so
character.
I said, "Well, tell me about her." And he said, "She's a country western superstar, and her name is Lainey Wilson." And I said, "I love it." I'd heard the name. I hadn't heard her music. So then I started listening to her albums. She's phenomenally talented.
Yes, yes, yes.
We met. She came on board. She was incredibly eager. She listened. She was enthusiastic. And we just hit it off immediately and, you know, are great friends to this day. So we're so lucky to have her.
Yeah, he's so lucky still to be friends. Now, at the time that Taylor Sheridan said, let's bring on Lainey Wilson, she was already doing music
for the show. She's kind of an up-and-coming music star.
Right, kind of like the Walker character.
Yeah.
Who, again, he supplied
Ryan
music.
Ryan Bingham is his real name, and he's an actual real musician, but he plays an actor on the show.
Taylor said, yeah, let's bring you in here, and we'll just say you're getting out of prison, and we'll make you a ranch hand. So, at the time that Lainey Wilson
She's fantastic.
Yeah. And at the time that Lainey Wilson was coming on the show.
She's rocketed to even greater stardom because she's been on the show.
Right. So, but at the time she came to Yellowstone and on the TV series, real quick, she was only selling 87 tickets for a performance in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. This is the springtime 2.5 years ago. All right. Then she was in Nashville for 12 years, trying to get a start. Okay, there's something going on this TV show, Yellowstone. Now she is reigning CMA and ACM Female Vocalist of the Year. She's had 4 number one country songs. And again, you have Ian Bowen as Ryan on Yellowstone saying, yes, we are still friends.
The Yellowstone effect
cool.
there, right?
Yeah. All right. So episode.
Makes stars even bigger stars.
Yep. So we're getting episode 13 this weekend, episode 14 the following weekend. The great thing that Taylor's doing, everybody thought, oh, he's only going to show this on Paramount Network. He is, as soon as the episode airs Sunday night at 8, he then opens it up if you want to purchase from other streaming TV networks. To buy an episode as low as $1.49, maybe he's got a little bargain going on here, like
so
over the weekend.
YouTube TV, they replay it on YouTube on one. I think they have a channel dedicated only to Yellowstone.
Yeah, and
so
eventually we'll get to late winter or spring that you'll see it maybe on Paramount Plus or something on the other one. But anyway.
Coming up next on the social media sweep, John Kerry, socialist on social media. We'll do that as we sit in for John Carlson here on a Tuesday. John will be back tomorrow, but we'll do that next here on KVI.
Talk Radio 570 KVI, The Commute with Carlson. Time for the social media sweep.
We're going to do an interview about a new law for electric vehicle RVs. We're going to do that interview coming up next year as we sit in for John. But right now, time for Socialists on Social Media. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. John Kerry was at some sort of conference. It's something about the Institute of Politics at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he said we're on the brink of needing to declare a climate emergency.
So I think, personally, we're on the brink of needing to declare a climate emergency, which is what we really have. And we need to get people to behave as if this really is a major transitional challenge to the whole planet.
Okay, stop. Secretary Kennedy, climate czar Kennedy. Did you not pay attention to the outcome of the presidential election? It's jabber like that that caused the outcome of the presidential election. Have a little self-awareness. And somebody else pointed out in the comments thread where that clip was posted. Kerry means that his bank account is on the brink and he needs more fear to line his pockets. So there's the response to the latest thought process from the climate czar, John Kerry. All right. Coming up next, the state of Washington is joining with 6 other states, including California, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, a couple others, and they're going to impose restrictions on the sales of recreational vehicles, RVs. And Jay Inslee wants this new law, but he's going to get sued over it. We're going to talk to an RV dealer in Monroe that has another location in Arlington. We're going to talk to a manager there. We're going to try and sort out what's going on with this law and why it is so awfully misguided.
Turning up the overnight heat from the right side of the aisle. Red Eye Radio. Weeknights, 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. KVI. KVI.com.
Trailers for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets.
The open road.
Yeah, I gotta say, growing up with seven kids in my family, mom and dad, Volkswagen bus for years, camping, 2 weeks at Yellowstone. My promise when I was old enough to drive is to get an RV. Class C, Class A. I went for a truck camper because I tow a boat. I am anxious, Phil, on this story you set up. Anybody with an RV, don't you dare go away from your radio.
Yeah, this story's been percolating for a couple of weeks. It's starting to get a little bit more of attention. Sitting in for John Carlson this morning, I'm his producer, Phil Vandervoort, Mark Christopher, the radio legend there. This is state law that's going to go into effect in a year or so. I think 2026 is when it goes into effect. But it's all mirrored off of law in California. Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts have all decided to join in with California imposing a law. It says here, it says January 1st, 2025, California and following states are banning gasoline and diesel motorized RVs. It's in compliance for a new law signed about a year ago called the Advanced Clean Truck Regulation. It affects any vehicle with a gross vehicle weight over 8,500 pounds. Now, if you drive a typical SUV, I have a 2005 Honda Pilot is one of my cars. My pickup, right around 5,000 pounds.
My Dodge pickup is 8,200 pounds.
Yeah, okay, so that's a three-quarter ton.
Three-quarter ton.
You're right,
and I haven't put the
this
camper on yet.
Yeah, you're right next to this gross vehicle weight then for an RV. And the point of the legislation is to cut emissions drastically. That's where Governor Inslee comes into this equation, by forcing manufacturers to switch to electric vehicle RVs, so EV RVs. And joining us now from Open Road RV in Monroe, and they've also got a lot, a dealership in Arlington, is Shelley Jensen, who's the controller and an attorney for Open Road RV, Richard Avis. Shelley, Richard, thank you for joining us here on KVI this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I inquired about you coming on to talk about how this new law, and is your understanding that this goes into effect January 1st, 2025?
It is.
Yeah. So this is basically going to mean that you can't sell a new RV unless it's electric. Now, you could sell older models, but you just couldn't sell new models. So what kind of impact is that going to have on Open Road RV in Monroe and Arlington?
Well, we're not clear on the law.
Okay.
But I will tell you that we have nothing electric on order. The manufacturers haven't even made anything electric to sell to us. And I don't believe we have any demand for an electric motorhome.
Yeah, I mean, an electric vehicle, passenger vehicle, a really good one would get a 300-something-mile range, but that's a vehicle that probably weighs 3,000, maybe 4,000 pounds. When you start talking a vehicle that weighs double that, you're going to have a tough time getting much more than a 100-mile range, maybe a little bit more than that under a best-case circumstance. And so, as you noted, manufacturers aren't even prepared to offer up a vehicle that fits this status to go with this law in California, Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. So what do the dealers, because you, what do the manufacturers, you as the dealer, you work with the manufacturers, what do the manufacturers tell you about how this is starting to go into effect?
Well, they've been quiet, and they are not prepared. The cost to our business is going to be great. It really was thrown at us very quickly. And so it's going to hurt all of the dealers in Washington. I mean, we don't know yet what the cost of putting in a charging station would be. We don't even know if there's going to be a demand for this. And quite honestly, people who want to buy an RV and travel the United States don't want to stop every 100 miles to charge it.
Yeah, that range question is the big factor for any purchase of an EV. My understanding is that there's going to be some litigation about this. Richard, What can you share about that status? Is there a way to either get a delay on this? Because it, clearly the marketplace does not match up the restrictions that the Olympia politicians, legislature, Governor Inslee want to impose at this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it it could be argued that this kind of the tech is not caught up with the government enforcement or and their rulemaking
or the preferred law. Sure.
Yeah, just getting kind of get ahead of your skis a little bit here, and there is going to be litigation for sure. But it is, you know, it is now law in California, will be in January 1st of next year. It's been through all the rulemaking and all the public comments, so it is the law, and Washington is committed to follow the California law, which means starting January 1. And this is all on the manufacturers. We're kind of like the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah, you're sort of stuck in the middle a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. And the manufacturers now to sell into Washington State have to have 5% of their units that are ZED, which is zero emission vehicles, meaning no tailpipe emissions.
Yeah, basically an electric vehicle.
That's their requirement, basically electric vehicle. But it's 5%, and it's a percentage that increases every year through 2035 right now. So the question is, but as Shelley points out, we do have this impact in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly the manufacturer is going to pass on cost of compliance. There'll be training of our sales staff. I mean, it's a whole new game when people are asking questions about, you know, about the range, about the price points, about the power, about the replacement battery costs. And the price points are probably going to be higher. So we have all these things. And the last thing is could be most important, and that is what happens if our manufacturers can't comply? Now, they can either comply by making by selling 5% that are ZEVs, or they can buy credits if they can't comply. But what if they can't do either one? Will that impact significantly all our inventory coming from a given manufacturer? And it's possible. So
a little bit more context to what you were just pointing out here. Where's the incentive going to be for the manufacturer to go, well, why am I going to bother making a product that's only going to be sold in a few states? I can sell my vehicles in all these other states, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Nevada, Arizona, where they don't have to comply with this law that emanated from California. And then could you end up with a scenario where people just go out of state instead of buying an open road RV in Snohomish County? Like, well, I'll just go over to somewhere in Post Falls, Idaho or something like that, and I'll buy my non-EV powered recreational vehicle over there, and then I'll just bring it back into Washington.
Well, that's a very good point. And Shelley says, I want to take this one. So,
well, I'll tell you, there is no incentive for the manufacturer. And, you know, you look at it, here's another thing to look at. We sell fifth wheels that weigh 24,000 pounds that have to be towed by a big Dodge Dually or Ford Dually, right?
Yeah. Probably a diesel vehicle.
You can't, exactly. So as you said to me yesterday, they're creating trying to create a solution to a problem that isn't there, first of all. Nobody wants this. They're hurting the dealers in Washington State. And I've always said this is a very non-business friendly state. The only state with B&O tax.
Yeah.
You know, it's affecting people's livelihood. They're pushing something on us that nobody's asked for and nobody wants.
Shelley, a question I have. This is Mark, RV owner, and thanks to you and Richard for getting on board. I think you're like the first two to get on the air and talk about this here. I know some people that have been doing coaches, okay, buses for a local ski resort. I won't say which one. And they were doing gas motor, you know, and then somebody said, well, let's get some battery-operated buses. They've already seen, because of the battery capacity on these 40-foot coaches to get skiers up to the ski resort, is going to take a lot of room where skis and snowboards would be stored. So that's a limit. Plus the fact, what the heck do you do with that coach after 2.5 hours or 200 miles or so? How long is it going to take to recharge? Shelley, I know you said they've been kind of in the dark throwing this at you, and I'm sure for you too, Richard, being, you know, the legal part behind it. Do we even know what one of these RVs, electric RVs, would even cost compared to the ones we have now?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We have had no communication with the manufacturers on this. We have one of our manufacturers that I am told by Andrew, our sales manager, that is working on something like this. But it's just, I mean, don't get me started on the liberal politics here in Washington.
That's the cornerstone of what's happening here. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I promise you, I will be in front of this and I will be fighting.
Yeah. And you know, Open Road RV, you're a controller there. That means you deal with the finances for Open Road RV in Monroe. And then, of course, another lot in Arlington, and Richard handling the attorney work there for Open Road RV. And you're part of a coalition of other RV dealers all across Washington that are kind of coming together to figure out a response to this. So let me use that as backdrop to ask Richard this final question. Is there any chance legally you can go to court and get a stay on this law going into effect in Washington, given all these circumstances that you're going to have adverse impacts, the technology is not there to meet the demand that this law is going to impose?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, there's always a chance, but, you know, I think in my mind, this is as much a political question as it is a technical question, and I think there's headwinds there. You know, they're trying to make these nudges to push the dealers, the manufacturers to get in the game of ZEVs. And they feel, I think a lot of the government people feel they won't do it unless we push them. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to strike kind of like this dumbbell or the, you know, a barbell. You've got the consumers on one end, you got the manufacturers on the other, and then the government's kind of the middle trying to balance the two. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there's going to be an effort and maybe there'll be some class actions going here.
Okay.
We'll have to be looking into that.
Yeah, that would be another legal avenue. Well, Shelley Jensen and Richard Avis, they're both at Open Road RV in Monroe. They're kind of having to deal with the fallout from this, what I think is a prematurely proposed and imposed law coming from Governor Inslee. And it's all just a copycat law from something that the state of California has already done with their, I think it's Carbon Reduction Board. That they have in California. So thank you both for coming on to talk about this. There is going to be far more news about this law.
Keep
and
in
what
touch
it means.
With us, both of you.
And
I so want to follow this.
Absolutely.
Oh, big
you
time.
Haven't heard the last from us on this.
And we'll, you know, be happy to keep updating the listeners about the status of this because it's just a very simple fact that the law is way too far ahead of where actual technology is for the consumers at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, absolutely. Shelley, Richard, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate both of you speaking here on John Carlson's show, okay?
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, there's a whole lot more to talk about this. I think we've kind of just initially scratched the surface on this. But
indeed.
We wanted to get this ball rolling to kind of cover the story. And this kind of has parallels to Initiative 2066.
Yep.
Where the natural gas access and the state, the politicians, Jay Inslee, want to do everything they can to stop natural gas. And the voters said, hey, look, this makes no sense.
Drive when you're driving I-5, yeah. Everybody, through Fife,
oh,
and what
sure.
have you. Look
all
at the RVs on both sides of the
exactly.
roads here. And yeah. you're going through Kent, Auburn, whatever, and think, okay, these are going to all be electric eventually. And right. what do
all
we
right.
do with these other ones?
We got one more segment. I want to talk about this new Chevy truck commercial that caught my attention during the Thanksgiving break. We'll do that next in for John Carlson.
Reminder, there's no such thing as a right not to be offended. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
John Carlson's out today. We're wrapping up the show. I'm Phil, his producer. Mark Christopher's here. John will be back tomorrow, so we'll get back to the regular schedule with John tomorrow, do legendary lyrics. Over the Thanksgiving break, watched a lot of ball games, and I kept noticing this commercial that came up. And I tend to watch particularly sporting events on the DVR so that I don't have to sit through the commercials. But I kept seeing this one come up, and it caught my attention, and then I finally saw it in live time, and it was just a really well-done commercial. And so many commercials are just done haphazardly and just don't really maximize the moment. But it's a Chevy truck commercial, and it's about a father and a son, and I don't want to give away too much of the backstory. You'll see it. You know about it. But the short answer is, it's a father and a teenage son, and they pull out of the family barn in a vintage, mid-80s, nearly mint condition, full-size Chevy truck, and they go for a drive through town, but they're talking about the teenager's grandfather and the dad's dad, and it's just really well done. Here they are pulling out of the family barn for a drive through town.
Granddad taught me everything about this truck.
It says here how many RPM.
So here's a flashback.
But I just listen to the sound. Bring it down too much. Then it's whoop, whoop, whoop.
Talking about the idle on the truck.
No,
what a big heart you have. You're kind. And he loved how curious you were about his work, how you wanted to help him build things. William's house, how's your granddad?
He built that one too, didn't he?
Yeah, he'd be the first to tell you about it.
See that place over there, Kevin?
Yeah.
I built that.
There's another flashback.
You can re-roof the church for free.
So, and then that is a section I took out of. They do a 5-minute version of this commercial that they posted online. So the commercial that they put on broadcast is much shorter and heavily edited. But just you see the dad and the son. They're talking about the grandfather and they're driving through the town. And it's got all the perfect Americana, you know, farming town, rural town imagery. It's just a really well done commercial. I almost started crying when I watched it.
Teardrop. Yeah, and last year, you might remember the Christmas one with the grandmother, Alzheimer's, and the family was sitting there and hearing, oh, she's not doing too good. She has a bad day. Then the granddaughter took the grandmother out to the garage. They uncovered the pickup truck her and her husband had for years. As soon as she got in it, she was remembering all the fun times they had with it, and she was back in current
time. Triggers her memory. So.
Another tearjerker.
Yeah, when they're done well, they're really cool to watch. But that's one caught my attention from all the Thanksgiving break stuff I got to pay attention to. Hey, I'm Phil Vandervoort, John's producer, Mark Christopher there. Thanks for running the show, Mark. John Carlson's back tomorrow. Markley Van Camp and Robbins are up next.